Hello, my name is Tucker Johnson, and I am your host today as we experience NIMSY Live, where we talk about the latest and greatest in translation, localization, internationalization, culturalization, and all that fun stuff global companies need to delight their international customers. On this program, we invite guests who like to have fun and have some value to add for our audience of globalization professionals. I'm always eager to provide a platform to those with a good story or a good data set. So let us know if there are any topics you'd like covered or guests we should reach out to for future episodes. If you haven't already done so, make sure that you are subscribed to NIMSY Insights. We are coming to you live today on LinkedIn, X, Facebook, and a bunch of other social media platforms. You can also go check out our archives over on our YouTube channel, where we have a bunch of NIMSY Live episodes, a bunch of interesting interviews, as well as a bunch of workshops and educational materials for the industry. So make sure to go check that out. Without further ado, today I'm going to jump right into it. Today we have a returning guest on the show today, Mr. Tim Brooks. Tim Brooks is the founder and executive director of the Endangered Alphabets Project. Since 2010, he has given talks and exhibitions about script endangerment at over 150 venues, including Harvard, Yale, Cambridge, the Smithsonian, and the Library of Congress, and NIMSY Live. Don't forget that. Right. Tim has a new book come out. So let's talk a little bit about that. More than 85% of the world's writing systems are threatened, and with them, the entire written record of their culture of origin. How does script loss affect a people? And why are so many cultures working to revive their traditional scripts or create new ones? These are the subjects covered in a new book by Tim titled An Atlas of Endangered Alphabets, a global exploration of the many writing systems that are on the verge of vanishing and the stories and cultures that they carry with them. Tim, welcome to NIMSY Live. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Good story, good data set. Those are my middle names.
Good. We'll see if we can fit it all into an hour today. Congratulations on the new book. We were talking a little bit earlier about this, and it's part of a trilogy. So there's a lot of work around. Well, but before we go into the new book, who are you? What do you do? I know who you are. I know what you do. And it's really cool.
Well, but as soon as you say trilogy, it makes me sound like a science fiction author, which I'm not.
I've been thinking you kind of have Tolkien vibes.
Right? I could do that.
I could see it. Because he was a linguist too.
We're both
too.
Oxford guys. Yeah, it's true. And the gray hair. Yep, Gandalf. So yes, I've spent all of my adult life actually as a writer, although I've also been a soccer coach and tour guide and all of those other jobs that people have. And in 2009, I sort of stumbled on two things. One, the fact that I like carving things in wood. And two, the fact that many, in fact, the vast majority of the traditional scripts or writing systems of the world are actually in danger of extinction. And what I did was I put those two together and I started carving pieces of text in these wonderful, extraordinary alphabets, alpha syllabaries, and all these other different forms. Yeah, exactly. So that's all some of my recent work. That round one is a tabletop, in fact, that I just finished. Yep, that one there. So that is Tibetan calligraphy by the great Tibetan calligrapher Tashi Mannix. That's a tabletop that is actually about to be a reward in my current Kickstarter, which we'll get onto some other time. Anyhow, so in those last 15 years, I've been sort of exploring the world virtually and trying to find all of these rare, endangered, in some cases suppressed or secret writing systems and scripts, and in particular, as you said, to try and understand the people who created them, who used them for all, you know, important purposes, why they were endangered and what that means, because it turns out there is nobody else in the world who is studying this critical issue of what happens when your writing system is either banned all the last people who know how to read and write it die off. What happens to that people, to their sense of identity, to their sense that they belong on this planet?
And it's an important distinction here is we're talking specifically about endangered alphabets, not necessarily endangered languages. Now, right. There's certainly a Venn diagram that has both of those too. But do you find that most of the alphabets that are on your radar are also in danger of the language going extinct as well? Or is it more where the language is maybe not flourishing, but the language is healthy? It's just right. No one's using the writing script anymore.
Yeah. So this is a great question, because up until 1995, roughly, nobody cared about endangered languages. They thought, languages are like trees. They die in the end. And of course, this was nonsense. It was languages die because the people who are using them are persuaded, coerced, or forced to use a different language. And when the last speakers die, it's extremely hard to reconstruct how a language actually worked. So people have been working on this since, as I say, the mid-1990s, and there's now a wonderful, strong movement to document, to understand, and in some cases to get involved and help revitalizing traditional endangered languages. Nobody's doing endangered writing systems. And as you say, sometimes they're very much the same thing. Sometimes they're one but not the other. So when Indonesia gained independence after World War II, the new government had this problem. They've got 17,000 islands. They've got six major religions. I think it's the world's fifth largest population. How are they going to create a sense of unity? And so they said, okay, so we're going to have an official Indonesian language, which was essentially Malay. And we're going to have an official Indonesian script, which is the Latin alphabet. Now, all over those islands, people were speaking their own languages and writing their own scripts. There are at least 20 different scripts in Indonesia. And of course, almost at once in the schools, they stopped teaching the Latin traditional alphabet, and they started introducing Latin alphabet and trying to get it to fit all of these different languages. So that's a great example where the languages themselves are active. They're not all flourishing, but they're in much better shape than the scripts, which within two generations, a script can essentially fall completely out of use. And that's the situation with many of the minority scripts throughout Indonesia.
And is it, when we're talking about scripts, when I think of script, I think of cursive.
Uh-huh.
Is cursive on your list, by the way? Because I could make an argument that cursive is a dying alphabet.
So Tucker, your listeners and viewers don't realize that I paid you a large sum to ask that question, because in fact, every single time I give a talk about what I'm doing, somebody asks that question. And eventually I realized that this whole issue of minority scripts around the world being endangered actually is part of a bigger issue, which is writing itself. And in fact, my next book, right, assuming that my current Kickstarter, I hope, is funded, is actually going to address exactly the question you're talking about. So there is this strange paradox right now where in places like Nepal, you have this wonderful organization called Kalajatra, which is doing these kind of guerrilla pop-up calligraphy workshops on the streets and the markets, and people are sitting down and they're writing their names for the first time in generations, because their script was banned by the government for 100 years, pretty much. Anybody who wrote in it could not only be arrested, they could have all of their property confiscated. That's what we, when we're talking about an endangered alphabet, bam, you know.
Yeah.
And so they are realizing that when you teach writing, you're teaching not just learning of symbols. You're teaching an activity in which you rehearse those symbols with your physical body. It becomes part of who you are. And in fact, there's a lot of studies, there's one in Scientific American recently, which show that if you take notes, or if it, as a child, you learn to write, you know, with, as I'm doing here with a pencil, it becomes ingrained in your muscle memory. You learn it more quickly, you retain it better, and you process it, because there is this interesting loop between your eyes and your writing and your body and your hand, and they all interrogate each other and reinforce each other. So in these minority cultures around the world, they understand this, and they're saying, by teaching these traditional scripts, we're not just teaching them the digital keyboard. We're teaching them how to write the way their ancestors did. Meanwhile, in the digital West, we're doing exactly the opposite. We're saying, oh, we'll have our kids learn on keyboards. It'll be quicker, and they can email people faster, and we'll have AI write our reports for us and stuff. And so the question that you asked, what about handwriting? What about the physical act or the physical art of writing by hand? And that's really what my next book is going to be about. And it's sort of about the future of writing. And we're at a point in history right now, and your followers and your listeners and your viewers are absolutely in tune with this, where we face these huge questions about what writing is, what we want it to be, and how we want to be involved in it.
Yeah. And it's very true. I'll just back that up. I remember when I was in college, when I would study, the way that I would study is I would rewrite my notes, because I found that that was the best way to ingrain it into my head. And now I've got kids of my own, and they're doing handwriting drills. And at one point I was thinking this exact same thing. I was like, how long does our culture have that until kindergartners aren't taught handwriting anymore because everything's digital?
Right. So there's actually another piece of this that is really kind of insidious that I think we didn't really think through. So I got this amazing email when I was finishing up my last, most recent, not this one book, which is called Writing Beyond Writing, from a young woman in Java in Indonesia. And she said that she had just come across a package of letters that her grandfather had written when he was a soldier in the Indonesian War of Independence after World War II. And she was sort of fascinated by this because she wanted to know who he was and what this was like and what it was like to be at that moment in their country's history. But she couldn't read them because they were written in traditional Javanese script. And so what she was doing was she was learning the Javanese script so she could reconnect with her family past and her national past and her cultural past. And I thought, you know, when we introduce more and more sophisticated digital tools, we're doing the opposite. We're actually driving a wedge between the generations. And we're also driving a wedge between the youngest generation and our history, because it's written in documents they can't read.
Right.
Even again, even there, if they found their grandfather's letters, if they were written in cursive, they would struggle to read them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know, I mean, shoot, even I almost struggle to write in cursive these days, but I don't even think it's being taught in schools anymore. And, you know, I'm a translation guy. I work in the translation industry, and anyone that's been in our industry is, you know, maybe at some point tried to translate a 19th or 18th century handwritten document. And the biggest struggle isn't the translation. It's just the transcribing it. So, you know, understanding which, what words do I need to translate it, actually?
Yeah, exactly. And what that means is that if you have a basic understanding of the shapes and the forms, you can make better guesses at what the individual letters would be. So right before COVID, I went out to Lockworld, which of course many of your listeners are familiar with, in San Jose. And I had created this game, which was called Glagolitic Hold'em. Right, it was poker, but instead of playing it,
I think that's the one that a bunch of people got in trouble for because they were
mostly me, yes.
betting or something.
No, we weren't actually betting, but it sounded as if we were going to be betting. Yeah,
we got in trouble with the hall monitors.
Right. So what happened is that I gave everybody a cheat sheet, which had a number of words in this script, which was invented over 1,000 years ago to write church documents in Eastern Europe. Uh-huh. And it's still in use to the tiniest fraction, but super endangered. But it's a beautiful, incredible alphabet. And so everybody got dealt cards and they had to look at their hand and then look at this cheat sheet of words in this alphabet and try and make words, and you would get more points for, you know, more complicated words. And at first, everybody was just horrified, just gobsmacked, because it's one thing to look at an individual symbol and be told, okay, this symbol here is a B. To look at a group of symbols straight away is like overwhelming. But then what you realize is that when you and I read a script we know, we actually see clusters of symbols, which we don't even bother to process one by one. If you see a word ending with ing, you don't even really look at the I, the N, and the G, right?
Yep.
And so, and likewise, if you and I are playing Scrabble, we don't actually have to move all of the letters around. We're kind of in our head, we can sort of move them around. And that was during a period when I kept inventing endangered alphabets games to make that point that minority cultures don't have games like Scrabble, where you learn to visualize and manipulate writing in your own head. And in fact, if you look over, I'm just going to tip my, if you look over my shoulder this way, that's actually a Scrabble tile in Balinese that I made during that period to sort of illustrate that point. Hmm. It's far more of a challenge than you would think.
Well, I mean, and this is kind of gets to the heart of why it's important. It's to preserve these endangered alphabets is not just because the writing system, not just because it's beautiful and it looks great carved into a chunk of wood, but because writing system really reflects and I would say strengthens and perpetuates a way of thinking, a culture. The language we use and the way that we write is influenced by and in turn influences the way that we think, right? So it's an integral part of people's cultures here.
Yes, absolutely right. And in fact, one of the different, I mean, that is exactly true as you say it. One of the differences between endangered languages and endangered alphabets is that letters can achieve a kind of iconic value and familiarity that actually outlasts the culture's ability to read it. So in Mongolia, the state official seal, right in the middle of it, it has a letter from an alphabet they don't use anymore and haven't for hundreds of years. But it is so much part of who they are. It's so familiar. It's like a flag or a coin. You know, this represents us. And similarly, if you go to Ireland, you know, you go into a tourist shop and there are all of these trinkets like, you know, pendants and earrings and whatnot in the Ogham script. And the Ogham script hasn't been used for probably 1,000 years and hasn't even been fully deciphered, but it is Irish, you know. And in fact, because it predates Christianity and it predates the bloody English being in Ireland, it has this kind of deep roots quality that says, you know, this is who we are or were before the waters got muddied. Mm. And you find the same thing in West African scripts, where there are scripts that are pre-colonial, and they feel extraordinarily strongly towards them, because it's like saying, who would we have been if the French or the Arabs or the English hadn't been here? We might have been something like this. It's like finding a shard of pottery. It's like finding a stone with inscriptions on it. And in that sense, you know, these visual images that we call letters are something significantly more for them.
And so, and I can vouch for that, right? Having been to Africa, and I have brought home the posters with the different scripts, the Adinkra symbols and stuff.
Oh, I love them.
Wall. Yeah. And they're celebrated as part of their heritage. And is that true, though, in all cultures? Or do you find that some cultures are more than eager, I would say, to dump the old for the new? Because I've run across that as well.
Okay. This is why you're paid the big bucks. This is why you're the CEO.
Well, thanks for sending me the list of questions beforehand.
No, their insights is in the name of this for a good reason. You're the man with the insights. Yes. So I would say there are two other alternatives. So one alternative is everybody who speaks a language that uses the Latin alphabet. So we recognize that not only are the French their own culture, the Germans their own culture, the Italians their own culture, but we also recognize their own language is something that is theirs and they're entitled to. And we even recognize this on a more local level. So when somebody who is Welsh or Breton or Catalan says, you know, this is our language, then we kind of go, yes, good, you know, excellent. But everybody uses the Latin alphabet. And so consequently, we never encounter anybody for whom the alphabet, their alphabet, their traditional unique alphabet, matters as much as the Welsh language does to the Welsh. We just, because they're elsewhere and because, frankly, we conquered them. You know, the Latin alphabet is the bully alphabet. For decades, people used to believe the Latin alphabet was superior because it was used all over the world. It was used all over the world because it had superior lawyers, guns, and money.
Right, exactly. Great song.
And so consequently, we have great difficulty, A, learning other alphabets because we don't have to. Whereas if you grew up in India, you would learn several. You would use them every day. It'd be no big deal. But also, B, we don't understand why a particular alphabet means so much to the people who use it. Because for us, it's just like the alphabet. When I was doing my research, I kept on coming across this phrase, the alphabet. I'm going, which one? There's lots of them. No, the alphabet, you know, the Latin alphabet. There are also plenty of places where it is a debate whether to use the traditional script or not. So, for example, where I live, the ancestral inhabitants of this area are the Abenaki. And they have, like most Native American peoples, undergone all kinds of hardship and discrimination and just bad treatment. And today there are four sort of sub-tribes or bands of Abenaki in Vermont. And their language is one of the most endangered in the world. And as a result, and I'm talking now about languages rather than alphabets, because it's just like a really good analogy here. So there is one of these four that is fairly numerous, and they have a language expert and teacher. And he runs a program at Middlebury College in the summer where he teaches Abenaki, and 30, 40, 50 students come to learn it. And so for that particular band, their traditional language is really important as a one of their ways of defining themselves and helping themselves kind of move out of the shadows.
Right.
One of the bands is I think more numerous, but they don't have a language expert. They do a bunch of language work, and in fact, I helped them create a illustrated children's dictionary in Abnaki. But the other two bands, they are so few in number, and they don't have enough people who can speak the language, that in order to retain their sense of dignity and self-respect and tradition, they focus on other things. And so one has a tribal garden in which they cultivate ancestral seeds that the Abnaki have hybridized to be suitable for this harsh climate, you know, for generations and generations. And so, and then for other peoples, it might be music, it might be dance. You know, it's so much of it is not about language, it's about human rights, it's about social justice. And I work with scripts because the rest is just too big to bite off.
But, well, and because nobody else is.
And also because nobody else is, right. And so when I was growing up, I heard about the English Folk Song and Dance Society, which was doing fabulous work in archiving the words of songs and tunes and all this kind of stuff. And that is very much the kind of work that helps revitalize a culture. Mm-hmm. And writing or spoken language or both may be part of that rediscovery of self-respect and self-determination.
Rediscovery. So, and it kind of brings up the question of, can a language be brought back, whether a language or an alphabet, right? But let's just talk about language just for a sec, because, and this is why, because I've talked to you before about this, this is why you carve these alphabets into wood, because it's more permanent, right? So an alphabet can be preserved in a record. A language, once the last speaker of that language dies out, the language is extinct. Or am I wrong about that? Are there instances when languages and or alphabets have been brought back from the dead, so to speak?
The received wisdom is that it is next to impossible. And it's not just a question of vocabulary. It's a question of things like, how do the ideas link together? Because in every language and every culture, ideas tend to play together in different ways. And that might affect, for example, tenses. It might affect word order, all this kind of thing. It's very interesting and subtle. So I had thought that this was pretty much impossible. And then I came across a young woman out in southern Oregon who had, as a recent high school graduate, and she was literally just out of high school, she came across some wax cylinders of the last speaker of her language and the notes that had been made by a famous linguist about the language. And she took it on herself to use those recordings and those notes to try and relearn a language that hadn't been spoken in nearly a century. And she did it. As, I mean, obviously we can't tell because there's no one alive from a century ago, but
who's going to proofread her work, right?
it is the Tekelma language. And this, as I say, they're in Southern Oregon. And her first name is Elizabeth, and I'm blanking on her second name right now. But to me, she is just like a hero many times over for doing that, and for doing it at such a young age, and for recognizing that really, in many cases, the act of revitalization actually is carried out by the young, because the...
I was just about to say that. I was like, she's young. She has the energy for it.
And she hasn't been beaten down as long.
Yeah, she's not really as cynical as... Exactly.
Yeah. Not just cynical. I mean, repeated experience of rejection is a terrible thing. And of course, in many cultures, it's a multi-generational repeated experience of rejection and disappointment. I talked to the guy who invented the Osage script for the Osage people in Oklahoma. And he was telling me that right around the end of the 20th century, most people had given up on the Osage spoken language. His father said to him, you know, don't bother, it's dying, it's never going to go anywhere. And he came up with this realization that the language could be saved if he came up with an alphabet for it. Because in a sense, it would then have two forces, which would be supporting each other. And the alphabet would give that kind of visual iconicity to the revival movement. And he said two really important things about, you know, whether this would work or not. One was that many of the older Osage told him not to bother. It's like, why would we want to learn another alphabet? And so what he did was he deliberately designed it so it was reminiscent of the Latin alphabet, but different. Okay. So it wasn't too hard to learn, but it was their own. And their own is really important. And the other thing was that really early on, in the beginning of the 21st century, the tribal council said, yeah, we're on board. We want to do this. And so whatever happened and all the ups and downs, because believe me, there's a lot of ups and downs, they were going to back him. His name is Herman Mongrain Lookout. And it took 20 years, but by the end of that, they now have a working alphabet that's being taught and that is really now a symbol of hope for their language, but for them as a people.
And so we've talked recently about a bunch of different Native American tribes here. It's close to home, right? Very relevant. But this is all over the world, right? And so this kind of segues us into talking about the Atlas of Endangered Alphabets. And I found, I was at your website. I'll try to put the website into the link or into the chat here for those of you that are following along. But let's take a look at this that I found on your website, this map. This is really cool. Talk me through this a little bit. What are all these red dots on this map over at endangeredalphabets.com?
So you have to realize three things straight away. One, this is out of date. So this, we put this together when we first put the online, this is the online edition of the Atlas of Endangered Alphabets, which we put up in 2021. And since then, I've discovered at least another 150 scripts, which we haven't yet mapped. Secondly, the map, the pinpoints. So this is classic Google pin stuff. If you click on one of the pins, it takes you to a page which will tell you all about that script and the people, and it'll give you some examples.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. We don't mess around here.
Yeah, no, this is, that's a lot of pins, and you have a write-up like this for each one of those pins.
I actually have a write-up for more than that number of pins. This is, as I say, it's still a work in progress.
So this is the online. This is what the book is about. So this is the appetizer.
Print edition. This came out about 4 years ago. The print edition is coming out in 2 weeks' time. So the other thing is that the numbers are never going to be accurate because although the census, you know, when countries do a census, they ask, you know, what your language is, nobody asks what script do you write. And so, which is an interesting thing because it talks about how people don't recognize that that's an important thing.
Well, and if they did a census, it's like they're inherently not reaching a lot of people because if they only write in that script, what script is the census written in, right?
That's a really good point. And I was in northwestern Pakistan a few years ago, writing a book on a different subject altogether. And the census people, they go door to door. They don't even bother with stuff that's written. And I was actually doing a book on the polio vaccination campaign. And there had just been a terrible, terrible earthquake and whole villages had been destroyed. And they called the polio vaccinators in because they were the only people who knew who was where. Even the census people didn't get up to these remote villages because they couldn't reach them, because they were scared, who knows what. When we talk about a minority culture, we may be talking about, there's a script that I came across recently, for example, it is only used in one village in northeastern India, one village.
Wow.
And it's probably only used by, I would imagine, 200 people. So even knowing that it's there, given that these people are living remotely, you know, up in the mountains, in the jungle, it's even knowing it's there is something, but then nobody, sorry, I know of one person who's been there actually to study it and try and write it down and all that kind of stuff. He is Australian, of course, Australian anthropologists, bless them. They're determined to get out of Australia, and they flood throughout the entire region knowing nobody else is interested, and they do fantastic work. My hero is an Australian anthropologist called Piers Kelly, who is like the Indiana Jones of the endangered alphabet. Here's to you, mate.
I want to bring up, finally getting into this here. The book is available for pre-order. So we looked at the online version. I've already ordered mine. Here's my verification. I pre-ordered this on October 15th as soon as I found out about it.
Outstanding.
So talk to me a little bit about this. It's let's back up. Let's back up a little bit. You said this is actually the first of a trilogy.
Yes.
But it's like Star Wars numbering. Because
that's exactly right. I'll use that line.
The second came out before the first.
Yes.
So talk us through the whole project.
Yes. So in my mind, from roughly 2009 to roughly 2018, 19 is what I think of as being the voyage out. So that's when I started looking for these scripts and trying to find people who could read them and write them, or could send me a piece of text so I could carve them, and doing that whole research thing and trying to understand the mechanics, the economics, the politics, the military background between writing and these people, and why that was important. So that was the voyage out, and that's the Atlas of Endangered Alphabets. And it really takes you mostly all over the world. There are some places where there are a lot more than others, as you saw on the globe map there. The second book, it's sort of imagined that I was giving a talk about the Atlas of Endangered Alphabets, which of course wasn't out yet. And somebody said to me, okay, so you've researched all this stuff, you know all these things, but what has that taught you about writing itself? And that turns out to be a fascinating question, because people don't ask the same questions about written language that they do about spoken language. So University of Massachusetts Amherst, right? Great school, excellent for languages. They have 30 plus different courses on linguistics, on spoken languages, right? They have 0 to 1 on writing and written scripts and languages. And so the second book, Writing Beyond Writing, was really, having seen all these different forms used all over the world in these different ways, that totally changes our understanding of what writing is. Because as you mentioned, the Adinkra symbols of Ghana in Africa, they don't correspond to individual letters. I've heard them called Satzschrift, which means each one really corresponds to a sentence or a proverb or a piece of wisdom. So Writing Beyond Writing was really me stretching my mind as much as I could to try and understand what writing actually is. And that is a totally groundbreaking book in a different way to the Atlas. And then the third book, which I'm hoping to write if my Kickstarter comes through, is really what is the future of writing? Having seen the rest of the world, having seen what we're doing with writing, where is it all going? What is happening to this incredible tool, the greatest invention of the second millennium, you know, AD? What is happening to people's hands? Are they doing this or are they doing this? You know, what happens to our minds? And what happens, as we said earlier, to our cultures if we relegate writing to a chore that is being done automatically by an app or by a platform, and nobody writes to their daughter or their father, you know, anymore, saying, "This is what's going on in my life." I still recognize my mother's handwriting and my father's handwriting. You know, they left us a long time ago, but they were, they each had a totally characteristic way of writing. And you look at them, and I tell you, my mother, bam, she's right there with me as soon as I look at her writing.
Yeah. And to this day, when I get a letter in the mail from my mother, I don't even have to look at the return address. I know exactly. It's like ingrained in my memory. I needed to know it because of all those notes that I forged to my teachers for unauthorized sick days, right?
Uh-oh, Tucker's criminal past.
Exactly. But yeah, the future is, we can get into a bunch of stuff here. I mean,
it's in the balance. It really is.
It really is, because it could go either way. Because not only we could talk about scripts, you know, whether it's cursive or heck, just regular old handwriting, and what we're losing when we're abandoning that for typewritten, you know, on the computer, texting on the phone. We could talk about that. But now it's going one step further to the point where people aren't even composing their own thoughts anymore with large language models and ChatGPT and all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's going to get to a point where you have bots talking to bots, right? Like I'm curious about like the future of dating apps, right? You have two people that they swipe on each other, and each one is using ChatGPT to come up with the wittiest responses to each other. And that's going to make for an awkward first date, right?
They're never going to meet each other. Exactly. It's going to be an online relationship.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So actually, I'm doing a workshop next semester at SUNY New Pulse, you know, north of New York. And it's going to be facing this question: if I'm saying there is something really deep and vital about writing by hand, how am I proposing it gets reintroduced? So I need to take you back to the beginning of the 19th century, right? So there was an incredibly influential handwriting master who wrote a book that was then adopted and adapted by another guy, and then another guy adopted and adapted that and brought it to America. And by the 1830s, it had sold 3 million copies. And essentially, it was the kind of thing we're familiar with. It was the, here are some lines, here are the shapes of the letters, you have to copy them over and over and over again. It's a sign of how they thought about writing, and how they only understood it in one narrow way, that not only was learning to write simply this really precise copying, but they actually recommended that the student's hand be tied with ribbons into a certain posture, and even the student be tied to the chair in a certain posture, in order to achieve the most perfect result. You know, this was a time when this was like a scientific method, right? And so when
God forbid if you're left-handed.
Yes, exactly.
You get the
ruler. When you talk to people about their experience of writing, especially if they're of a certain age, on the one hand, they say how important it is. On the other hand, they say how they hated being taught by, you know, nuns with rulers, or just kind of going over and over and over again until I actually have, I'll hold this up to the camera. I actually have a dent in my finger right there. From writing so much as a child. That's where my pen or my pencil fitted in. And if we're going to reintroduce and revitalize writing as a form of self-expression as well as a form of communication, we can't do it the old way. I was writing this book a number of years ago about the history of the guitar. Great book.
I noticed that, like, just on stream here, I clicked over to your author page.
Yeah.
And it was, holy moly, you've written some books.
That was wonderful. But what I discovered was that the piano came into America in the late 19th century. And it was sold as a Christian instrument. A Christian household needed to have a piano. And they actually did a lot of study, because it was a new instrument and because it was so expensive, a lot of study as to how many kids actually had piano lessons and how many of them gave up. And it turns out that ever since the piano was introduced, something like 92 or 93% of all kids who've had piano lessons have given up. And when you think about the way that piano is often taught, which is with the same really rigid, precise, unenjoyable way as writing,
yep,
you know, 92% of people would give up writing if they could. They would go, yes, bring me ChatGPT right now.
Yep. Exactly. And the thing is, they could. Like, my kids could. Their generation, they could. They will get by never having to handwrite anything in their lives if they really needed to, right? They won't. They will learn how to write and stuff. So it's, you know, it's not that dystopian yet, but they totally could get by with all the technology available today. Yeah. I mean, heck, yes, I could get by. And when I sit down to write something, I'm amazed at how quickly my hand tires out. Right? It's like, yep, I picked my saxophone up from the shop the other day. I got a saxophone back there, right? I picked it up from the shop the other day. I haven't played for 5-10 years. I don't know. Long time. It was, you know, it was broken. I couldn't play it. And I was like, after 5 minutes, my embouchure was just, I couldn't blow anymore. And it's the same with the hand. I'm out of practice with it.
Yeah, right? And handwriting, it takes rehearsal, but it also takes... So one of the exercises that I'm thinking of doing is... So in Writing Beyond Writing, right at the end, the final chapter is an ode to the pencil. And there are many things about the pencil that are extraordinarily valuable, even if it's so cheap that we could drop it in the puddle and never pick it up and not think twice about it, right? So one of the really interesting things about writing with a pencil is that when I'm doing my carvings, I'm convinced that there is something very, very deep and embedded in us about a good, consistent curve. And I think it's because it actually involves a coordinated movement of the whole body. It's related to dance, in fact. And I'm going to reach over here. I'm not leaving the building. So what we're going to do is a series of exercises that produce something a little bit like this. So this is something, it's actually an ideogram. In other words, a symbol that conveys an idea. But the way I did it, and you can actually faintly see this on the back, is by just going over and over again in pencil until I found the shape that looked good to the eye and that worked well with the hand and the turn of the wrist. And the great thing about a pencil is that once you rehearse that and you get what you kind of like, you can go over it more and it gets darker and you wind up with a beautiful shape that you've done without having to do that thing with the, you know, where you're copying it, this tiny thing where it has to be a small O is almost impossible to do right. It's almost impossible because that there's not enough rigidity in the hand and there's not enough perfection in the eye to do a perfect circle. But luckily, we don't need a perfect circle for it to be a decent O. And the great thing about drawing in this gestural fashion is that you can find, first of all, you can find a shape that you like and it becomes pleasurable. And secondly, you're ingraining that into your hand-eye coordination, your eye-paper coordination. And I have come to really think that graffiti artists are onto something that is not much discussed, which is the fact that you can actually do these grandiose sweeps with a spray can. You know, you've got this great canvas, which is the side of a, I don't know, it's a subway train or something, uh-huh. or like it's an underpass. You've got this huge canvas and you can do these wonderful movements, which are the natural movements of the human body. You can express yourself. When you see a Mongolian calligrapher, this is the kind of stuff I'm going to talk about in Endangered Alphabets Calligraphy. When you see a Mongolian calligrapher, he's not going like this, you know, I have to make this perfect. He's going, wham! And there is this unbelievable, oh, my hair is now all over the place. There's this unbelievable drama. And you realize that, yeah, you're conveying emotion, not by saying, I feel excited, but by the very way in which the brush is attacking the paper.
Well, you know, if that's not a good case for handwriting scripts, preserving them, I don't know what it is. I am watching the clock, though, and shoot, as I should know better, you know. And when I started off, I said, oh, we might go half an hour, we might go 45 minutes. We could go all day with you. Tim, it's always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to have you
on. Thank you so much for inviting me. And it's also a real pleasure to talk to somebody who kind of sees the whole landscape. I mean, you really see the landscape of language in with a breadth and complexity that most people don't.
Well, my secret is I'm not an expert at anything. Because if I'm not an expert at anything, I can see the whole landscape. But don't ask me detailed questions. That's why I like to have experts on the podcast who know what they're talking about, like you. So I do though, before we go, Patreon, let's plug it. Kickstarter.
So this is going to be the third of the three books. And this is really the one that says, what is the future of writing? How can we not hand this over to the bots and the computers, and recognize, as minority cultures are doing around the world who are still teaching calligraphy as a way of, they are that one right in the middle, Mongolian calligraphy, that is just stunning. What do they know that we don't? What are we ignoring that they're recognizing is really, really important? So yeah, we need to raise another 10,000 bucks in the next 10 days and we can do it. And the rewards, keep scrolling down.
There's
the rewards.
Good stuff here on the rewards.
Great stuff. I know. Some of my carvings are in there. Some of my books are in there. Oh, there's
very, yeah, especially at these bigger levels. I've gotten one of your carvings before. Absolutely beautiful. Beautiful stuff to hang in your home. So yeah, really good rewards, everybody. I put the link to the Patreon into the chat over on LinkedIn. So if you're watching this on LinkedIn, you can follow that. Go check out the different rewards, the different levels of donations here, and support the work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Brooks. All right, sir, I will take us out here. Ladies, gentlemen, chat, we are out of time for today. If you enjoyed this episode of NIMG Live, then join us next on Wednesday. I believe Wednesday, Thursday, and maybe even Friday. No, Wednesday and Thursday. We have more episodes coming. And then on Friday, of course, I will be in Monterey. So hope to see a lot. Will you be in Monterey, Tim?
I wish I could. I actually wanted to go and then I got COVID and I thought, will I be better in time? So
yeah, well, thank you, I'm not going, staying home. Thank you for not exposing us. All right.
Yeah.
Well, I will see you guys.
Have a great time there.
Thank you. I will. So I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of you guys down there in Monterey. I appreciate our guest today, Tim Brooks. I appreciate my colleagues here at NIMSY Insights doing all the hard work so I can have these interesting conversations. And finally, I appreciate you, the audience, joining us live today. And I look forward to next time. Cheers.